You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today.
Friday, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters Friday. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show. Today on the James Altucher Show.
I never knew what being burnt out was. I remember when I was a kid, the other kids in school would be called the burnouts. Then there was the jocks, and then there was people like me, whatever you want to call me. I was called lots of things. Even as an adult, I've always worked very hard, and sometimes I'd get a little drained of energy, but I was never really burnt out. I didn't believe that burnout existed. I thought that was a myth. And somewhat recently, I've had an experience with being burnt out. In fact, I'm still kind of going through it. Probably the only thing that's surviving is the podcast and some other activities, but I really wanted to understand. I didn't feel like depressed. I didn't know what it was, but it was like physically affecting me, preventing me from doing things. And I've tried many odd and interesting things to kind of escape this burnt out feeling. And I had to really discover why I was burnt out. It's only been like the past month or so. You know, it'll definitely make an interesting story at some point. But first, I wanted to understand what this is. So I sought out someone who was an expert, a world-renowned expert on being burnt out, and she tells her story and gives me some advice, and I tell her what's going on with me. Here's the world-renowned expert on burning out, if it's ever happened to you or if you want to avoid it. She also hosts nomoreburnout.org, Natalie Rachel. And by the way, her stories freaked me the hell out. Here she is. Natalie Rachel is an expert on burnout. I'm kind of burnt out. But Natalie, first tell me, what does it mean to be an expert on burnout? Does that mean you get burnt out a lot, or it means you know something about it?
It's hopefully the opposite. Hopefully it should mean that I get burnt out less. But I have been burnt out. So that was kind of where my interest in it and it came from. I'm actually a behavioral economist by training, but my focus has been on decision-making and stress and the effect that stress had cumulatively on our decision-making process and our cognitive health. And that kind of led me to start looking at burnout and what kind of how the brain is affected when we're just chronically overstressed, overworked, and just kind of drained. And that's what it sounds depressing, but actually, you know, there is hope. People do recover from it. And that's what I help people do.
I feel like a lot of people say, oh man, I'm burnt out. But they're not really burnt out. Does burnout really mean? And why did you get into the study of it? Like, what does it mean to study it?
Yeah, so, I mean, maybe a good place to start would be like the definition of burnout is the World Health Organization defined it in 2019 as being an occupational hazard. And they defined it as being having sort of three defining characteristics. So it's kind of to define it as being different from just stress or exhaustion. So it's being in a state of energy depletion. So you feel very run down, very drained. Secondly, it will be there's a feeling of mental distance and negativity that you're conscious of between yourself and your colleagues and your family. And thirdly, it's reduced professional efficacy. So you're actually getting objectively worse and less able to do your job. So that will be when you're in that state, you're actually already burnt out. But as you say, it's a process and it's sometimes we're a little bit, we might say we're a bit burned out, but actually we can solve that just by resting and kind of taking a break. But true burnout is the kind of cumulative result of all these stresses. So for me, I've been like doing a lot of the kind of theory behind it, like looking at what are the drivers in the workplace that are causing people to be burned out, what's happening at the cultural level, the organizational level, and also the individual level. So that's kind of what most of my research focuses on. But then I'm actually trying to apply that now so that people can use it in practical ways to start walking it back if they feel like they're at risk of getting burned out.
How do you know if you're at risk of it? Like, what's the difference between being at risk and actually having it?
Yeah, that's a really good question, actually. And I think it's one of those things that when you notice it, you're probably already quite burned out. But kind of paradoxically, when you're really, really burned out, everything else in your life has kind of fallen into the background. So you're less conscious of how out of balance your life has become. So yeah, so how you know you're at risk, I think one way to think about it is like there are different stages to it. So it's a process. Like at the early stages, you might not actually feel bad at all. You might actually just feel that you're in kind of quite a passionate relationship with your work. You know, you feel enthused, you feel engaged with it. The kind of psychological contract between you and your job has maybe become a little bit unbalanced. I mean, I'm talking about a job. It could be something else, but let's just say a job for now. It's kind of become a little bit unbalanced. So you're finding that you're starting earlier, you're finishing later. You're maybe letting your other commitments slide in favor of doing more work. You're thinking about work outside of when you'd chosen to do it, when you should be thinking about something else, maybe. And so that's kind of the first intimation that things are a little bit unbalanced and that you're kind of becoming overcommitted and the blinkers have started to go on to like the other aspects of your life so that you're just kind of leaning into.
That's not burnt out. That might be, maybe you're suggesting maybe at that point you're overworked. So you're expending energy. The gas tank is running on empty, so you have to do other things to kind of optimize your energy and suggesting maybe that might lead to burnout.
Yeah, exactly. So what I would, if you just kind of wanted like a one sentence definition of burnout, I would say it's like, it's when you've got nothing in the tank, you've exhausted all your internal resources, but you're pushing on anyway. So it's like your mind and body are saying no, but you're just doing it anyway.
And so what's like the reasons for burnout? Because is it just that you took on too many commitments? Because I feel like people could do that for a long periods of time. And I'll tell my story in a second, but like, what brings on burnout?
I guess you could split it into like organizational things. Like you might be that your organization's going through a big change that's kind of being forced on you and you find yourself like having to take on work that either you don't feel equipped to do or it's too much and it's kind of your forced into a situation that you don't like. So there's kind of organizational factors, but then there's cultural ones as well. Like people are just burned out by the amount of distraction there is, the amount of pressure on them from different sources. And then kind of personal ones, like if your identity is very, and your purpose is very caught up with your job, with your role, with achievement, then that can also be a factor in driving your burnout because you just push on even when everything's telling you to stop.
Yeah, particularly if things aren't going so well, but if you identify your self-worth with the progress of whatever it is you're doing, whether it's a job or some other activity, maybe could that lead to burnout?
Oh, definitely, definitely. I mean, it's quite interesting. There was a story a couple of years ago, I think, in the Wall Street Journal about, I think it was called something like Beyond the Confetti. And it was about like all these kind of startup founders who were just plagued by these just hellish experiences of burnout because they just kind of, as you say, like they've got their identity completely fully identified with their company, with their role, with their vision.
Right, so and it's like an embarrassment to admit.
Completely. Yeah. And often it's like it beyond just embarrassment. Like often there's kind of billions of dollars, like investors' money and, you know, all your employees are looking to you to sort of set the tone for the organization. So like to admit that you're really not coping well at all. It's kind of, as you say, really embarrassing, but also maybe has real kind of business consequences as well. But I mean, what I would say is that the business consequences of just pushing on regardless until you crash can be even more dire. So.
Yeah. And I used to think like what you were saying earlier, burnout, something like, oh, I'm just a little tired of work right now. So I'm going to take a vacation and then I'll be refreshed. But now I realize it's something different than that.
Yeah.
It's not so easy to, it's not like just rest and you're okay.
That's it. And I think, like, you know, if you are able to just rest and be okay, that's brilliant. But it probably wasn't burnout. It was probably just ordinary exhaustion, ordinary tiredness. Because there's a definition of burnout from Freudenberger in the 70s. And he said it was like emotional and physical collapse brought on by stress and overwork. So it's that link with stress and overwork that's really crucial. It's not simply you're so tired because you've just done so much. Because generally, if you've, you know, if you've delivered a huge project or you've run a marathon or something, then you will be really tired, but you'll also be satisfied and you'll know that you can just rest and eventually you'll feel better. But with burnout, it's there's no sense of satisfaction. There's no sense that it's ever going to be over. And even when you rest, it's not truly restorative because you just kind of have that compulsion to keep going and, you know, have that sense that you're still not going to be satisfied.
And what's the difference between burnout and like depression?
That's a really good question. And often they do get confused. Often if burnout's diagnosed at all, it's quite often misdiagnosed as depression. So, I mean, they're linked, like they've certainly got a lot of overlap in symptoms, like the kind of low mood, the sort of feelings of disassociation, like the tiredness, the body aches, there's a huge overlap, but there's a study actually on the, I think it's just called the Medical Perspective on Burnout, and they do like saliva cortisol tests, and burnout and depression are distinct. I think the, I'm trying to think what exactly it is, but it's burnout is more similar chemically to post-traumatic stress disorder. So it's more like a kind of trauma response than a sort of long-term depression response, which I thought was quite interesting. And I suppose another way of a simple way of just passing the difference is burnout is associated with work. So you have, you know, the feelings of helplessness and anxiety are generally oriented towards your work, even if they do kind of spill over into other areas of life. Whereas I guess depression is more generalized.
Yeah. So like I've never been burnt out before in my entire life. And I work pretty hard. Like last year when I know because of the pandemic was very hard and a lot of people got burnt out or a lot of people lost their jobs and it was very frustrating. Work-wise, I was doing great. Like I upped my podcast from 2 a week to 5 a week. Mm-hmm. I was doing articles every day. I wrote 2 books. I started a business. I invested in businesses. I moved in general. And that's for 25 years. I'm a hugely productive person. Mm-hmm. And people always say, oh, how are you so productive? And I'm very efficient with my time. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think it was a matter for me. And let me fast forward to where I am now. I literally can't do anything. Like I have to be dragged to do a podcast. And that's not totally true. I do all the things I'm responsible for. I keep track of my responsibilities. Most of the time I do like the bare minimum. And I wrote this article in August. I think this was related to getting burnt out. I wrote this article in August called New York City is Dead Forever. Here's why. And I got a lot of people liked it, but a lot of people that I knew and was friends with and people I even, you know, was close to and other people I admired hated it. And let me know about it. So
that's tough. Yeah.
30 million people liked it. And about 1 million people let me know how much they hated it and how much they hated me. And it was even like ex-girlfriends writing articles about me people who used to work for me, like commenting or sharing these articles that were against me. And I was always like really surprised. And I even was fine with all of that. And then sometime maybe 4 or 5 months later, it was still going on. I've had negative reactions on articles before, but I never had this much. And then there were other things too, like, you know, just in general, you know, I at any given point, I have 7 or 8 things going on because I like to do what I call diversify my dopamine. So if something's not going well, presumably one of the 7 other things will be going well and fine. But gradually everything just shut down. And I think it was because I think my brain was telling me, you're going to get punished if you stand out anymore. And so somehow I just like shut down and that was that. And then, And then everybody was saying, oh, you're going to have to get back to normal. You're going to have to get back to normal. But I don't think there's like a normal. I don't think it's like you're burnt out and then there's normal. I think there's like a new normal, as they say.
I agree.
I don't know what it is. So I don't know. I don't know how to get out of this burnout. Or I've literally tried everything. I've tried like huge numbers. I've tried unusual things, like experimental things. I've tried everything.
Okay.
This is like a therapy session.
It's fascinating because everything that you do sounds like you are doing the right things, like the diversification. I mean, if you can broaden your self-concept, that's something that people do find helpful if they can find that they're getting their nourishment from lots of different sources, like their nourishment to themselves. So that's a good place to start. But I think that maybe, you know, like you say, it is transformative. Like that's something that people don't always realize with burnout. They do just try to bounce back to where they were before without really acknowledging that they're not going to be the same person as they were before. Going through burnout is hugely transformative, and then coming out the other side is as well. And generally people don't stay the same. I mean, it's quite an interesting study, but there's a lady called Dr. Jerry Paleo, who does a lot of the work on linking burnout and post-traumatic stress disorder. And she says that often when people come out, I think it was 90% of the people in the study, in her study, they not only don't go back to the previous employer, they leave the entire industry. Like they can't even stand to be associated with anything that might remind them of what caused their burnout. So sometimes like a complete hard reset might be a good way to approach it. If something's kind of, if you think of it in terms of like a trauma response where you're just kind of shutting down to protect yourself.
I think that's what it is. I think because most other areas were fine. They had their normal ups and downs for me, but maybe kind of simultaneously things were down or slow across the board. And combined with the fact that this overwhelming response, like it's so unbelievable. Some of the responses I got and still get. Here it is. What month is it? March. I wrote this article in August, and today I still have,
my goodness,
you know, people saying things. And not to describe the articles, I've done that before in this podcast, but people misinterpret it. Everybody gets everything wrong. And so literally it's like when I sit down to write, for instance, I'm trying to, and sometimes I succeed, but maybe I used to write every day. Maybe I've written 3 articles since November.
Yeah.
You know, and podcasts, we were doing 5 a week. Now maybe, Jay, how many are we doing? Like 2 or 3?
Yep. It's 2.
2?
Or 3. Yep, 2 or 3.
Sometimes 3. So like basically that the minimum needed to pay the bills here. And then, you know, and then there's other things, activities I'm involved in. But really I have like it's not like grabbing me like it used to. Like everything, I sort of think a big part of being productive is loving what you do, because then you don't have to spend the energy convincing yourself to do it.
Exactly, yeah.
And so with the burnout, I don't have that energy right now. And so consequently, I do, you know, nothing. Or I'll play like online chess all day or something like that. Like, but when I say all day, it'll be like 18 hours in a day.
Yeah.
I just wrote a book about being productive. And the book still holds, by the way, but it just doesn't account for if you're totally burnt out.
Yeah. I mean, that makes perfect sense. I mean, I think quite a few people maybe could relate to like just that feeling of intense like inhibition, like something has happened that kind of almost unconsciously you just don't feel safe being your full self at the moment. So it's kind of just shut down to kind of keep you safe. And I think that it's interesting. It's like that's come up before actually when I've been speaking to people, that the feeling that they're going to be misinterpreted and then attacked for expressing themselves is a really common trigger actually to just kind of shut down. And one of the things with burnout is it does stop people feeling connected to other people. And it also kind of stops people feeling autonomous at the same time. I think it's a really quite perverse condition, because when you think about like what it is to be human, it's like it's to be someone who's connected to other people, but also kind of autonomous in the sense that, you know your own inner voice and your own mind and you're able to express it, but also kind of connect authentically with other people. And when you're burned out, and I think one of the big feature, sort of big cultural drivers of burnout at the moment is the fact that we're kind of isolated, like physically at the moment, and also just kind of psychologically, but we're also bombarded as well. Like we have this instant feedback of other people's opinions, sometimes kind of, as you say, like willfully misinterpreting what you've said. And like, I've noticed it so much online, like people are already anticipating what people are going to say in response to them. So they've got this, it's quicker than instant feedback loop from other people because they've internalized what they're going to get bashed for.
Yeah.
And people aren't even talking about the same thing anymore. I know I'm sort of going off on a bit of a tangent, so do just kind of stop me. But one thing that's kind of been really noticeable in like the, let's just say like about the Harry and Meghan and Oprah fights that people have been having online, people are so sure that they know what happened when we don't. You know, no, none of us was there. But also they don't even agree on what's been reported, like what we're even talking about, what the situation is that's even under discussion. And yet they're kind of really going viciously at each other.
Like, yeah.
In a way that you never would in person, surely. But it's draining. It's incredibly draining to people. And I think that one of the responses people have is to just withdraw, either completely put on almost like a kind of fake persona, which is hugely alienating, or just pull out altogether. And the statistics on like how much time people spend online and the effect it has on their mental health and their well-being is pretty clear. It's almost perfect negative relationship. It's not a healthy environment to spend a lot of time.
Yeah. So what can you do about it? And like what you said earlier, like I'm really not so much an angry person or an irritable person. And I really enjoy all the things I do. But lately, because of this, I've been a little more irritable, perhaps because there's all this pressure to be back to normal. And it's just every day I think I'm going to get over it. And then by midday or even by morning, I'm just not. And I've never, past 25 years, I've worked 7 days a week. I love what I'm doing. Usually I'm super productive and I've never experienced this before, but maybe because literally a million people took the time out to hate me. And I'm not complaining about it. Like I like to write and I don't write unless I think I'm saying something interesting. And sometimes that makes it controversial and people argue, but this was above and beyond anything I've ever experienced.
Yeah.
And I literally starting around mid-November, early December, it was gradual, but I just totally shut down. And then by January, February, people started to notice. So like people wrote, how come you're not posting on different social media? How come you're not writing as many articles? And I felt bad, but I feel weird. I feel like there's some stigma associated with all of this because I'm supposed to be like super productive all the time. And right. I'm not being not productive because I don't want to be. It's just, this is happening. So what should I do?
I think the first step is to kind of maybe let go of that expectation that you've got to get back to exactly how you were before as soon as possible. I mean, maybe you don't need to be the same as you were before. Maybe you can be, someone different and just kind of and integrate this experience into what you do going forward. I mean, I'm just sort of, one of the things I'm just drawing on what other people have said to me in the past is like, in the kind of pressure to get back to how they were before, they skip almost like a kind of mourning process or like a grieving process that sort of acknowledges that something traumatic and disturbing happened to them. And the person that they were and the things they were going to do and the things they were looking forward to, they've lost them, even if it's just kind of temporarily. And just kind of give yourself a moment to feel sad about that if you want to, or kind of feel angry about it.
But how do you mourn that?
It is tough. I mean, what I would probably do is acknowledge it, maybe try and like articulate what it is that you feel you've lost and sort of not necessarily quantify it, but just kind of make it real, like, and without any judgment, like, you know, you're not, because sometimes people feel guilty about sort of talking about what they've lost when they think, oh, you know, there's people who've lost so much more. And and sort of beat themselves up about it. But I think it's fair to, you know, to feel sad about it. And I think one of the things when people have been either burnt out by work or by a sort of nasty experience, possibly like you had, is the sense of injustice, like the fact that, you know, possibly something's happened to you that wasn't entirely your fault. I mean, maybe, you know, maybe it's kind of something that you did initiated it or something, but if it's been willfully misinterpreted by people and sort of blown out of proportion, then I think that like having a trauma response to it is understandable, because it's a shock when, you know, when you put yourself out there and you're vulnerable and then it kind of gets completely out of proportion, smashed back in your face. It's, you know, that hurts. So I would certainly take a bit of time to, you know, sit with the, you know, with the grief and the anger about that. And then from there, just start to get curious again about what does really motivate you and what you want to do. That's because that's something that, and do feel free to just kind of stop me if I'm waffling, but
no, please.
Sure. So people often, like, one of the things I think that people who suffer from burnout, it comes as a bit of a surprise to them, is that they feel quite like they spend a lot of time thinking about themselves, and people might even say that, you know, they were quite self-absorbed, but it's not coming from a place of curiosity. Like, if it's, you know, I think a lot of the influence people say, like millennials, and I'm a millennial, but say that it's quite a narcissistic culture, and, you know, narcissists are kind of self-obsessed and so on. But self-obsession is very different to being curious about yourself, as in just really looking to get to know yourself without any judgment, without trying to manage other people's expectations of you, without any sort of preconceptions about what it's good to want, what it's good to be like, what you ought to be doing, how you ought to be perceived, and just kind of let that go and just really spend that time being curious about yourself. Because people don't know themselves very well. One of the things I found quite interesting is even what people think is going to make them feel good, whenever the psychologists do these kind of experience monitoring experiments, all the things that we think of as being like harmless fun, like just watching TV, eating chocolate, whatever, people actually find them mildly depressing. Like, when they report in the moment how they're feeling, there's like a teeny bit of relief, but then you're actually back to feeling slightly worse than you did before. You feel less motivated, less confident, less engaged. And I just think that's so, well, sad, but it's also fascinating how we don't really know ourselves that well at all.
Yes, it's totally true. Airbnb has changed my life. If anything, they have made my life so much better. Like, I used to live in Airbnbs. I lived in over 100 or 200 different Airbnbs over a 3-year period, and I loved it. I became a really good guest of Airbnbs, and I got to know lots of hosts. So when I initially owned a house, of course, the first thing I thought was, I'm going to turn my house into an Airbnb because I travel a lot. So why leave my house unused when I can make a side income by letting others Airbnb my house or come to stay in my house as guests? And having my own Airbnb or being a host for Airbnb has allowed me to do just that. And I've met other hosts. I've actually spoken at Airbnb's host conference. I think it was in 2017. I met so many just nice hosts. It's a great community. And I love, you know, turning my own home into an Airbnb. Like, I'm traveling to Austin next month. My home's going to be an Airbnb while I'm away, and I'll stay in an Airbnb. I'd rather stay in like a 3-story house Airbnb than in one tiny hotel room in the middle of Austin during South by Southwest. So listen, while you're away, your home could be an Airbnb. Many people host on Airbnb, but there are people who are just letting their house sit empty, who've never thought about it or didn't realize their space could be an Airbnb. Hosting can easily fit into your lifestyle and is a great way to earn some extra money. So if you have a home, but you're not always at home, then you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. I remember last year I was asked to go speak at the Norway Business Summit, and I was so excited because side by side with the Business Summit was the Norway Chess Summit, where I would get to see in person Magnus Carlsen, the best chess player ever, playing chess. But it was 4 plane rides, like, to get to the city that ultimately I would go to. So I really did not want to fly for 14 hours. And they were willing to pay for everything for me. So I at first class. So I didn't want to fly for 14 hours and not be first class. So I had to hurry up and get on the phone immediately to get those first class tickets to a chess tournament in Norway. And listen, this is just like when, you know, you have to know when you want the best of anything, you have to act quickly or someone else will get it instead. And I did not want those seats to fill up. So it's like if you're hiring for your business, you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. I just was talking to a friend this morning where he was trying to decide between some programmers and he waited a little too long and both the programmers he was interviewing took other jobs, like great jobs. So, you know, what's the best way then to hire the best as quickly as possible? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/James. Just try it and see. You'll find out. So ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify the top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. And I know this because one time I signed up as an employee, potential employee on ZipRecruiter, and I got nonstop, really, I was, even though obviously I wasn't looking for a job, I love what I do, but I just wanted to see what would happen because they were a sponsor of my podcast. And the most interesting jobs would pop up in my emails like, hey, you're qualified for this or that. And so it's interesting to see. So just go there and try it. Try ZipRecruiter.com/James. Amp up your hiring performance. Now, this is more for if you're hiring, but amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/James. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
Friday, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere. This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters Friday. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
I feel like there's 2 types of activities that people think are going to make them happy, other than socializing and meeting new people. So these are just in terms of like activities. Mm-hmm. So things like TV, where you enjoy watching shows, you relax, and you think that's going to make you happy. And then the other activity is when you're doing something you love. Like, let's say you love playing tennis and you play tennis, or you love, I don't know, you love being an accountant. So you go to your work as an accountant. Mm-hmm. And the latter category, they're not always pleasant because they're hard. And so like, if you want to be a tennis player, you're going to lose some games and that's not pleasant. Whereas TV is always sort of this mindless thing. And maybe it's not as happy inducing as people think. Whereas hard activities are not really meant to be happy. They're meant to be, you know, fulfilling and challenging. And and those are the types of activities that were, you know, for 25 years, I've been doing and enjoying, and I'm okay with them being difficult and being sometimes extremely difficult. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why this time over other difficult times, it affected me more.
I think that's a good distinction to make, like what people think of as kind of easy fun and then kind of hard fun. Because it's like, yeah, I mean, people definitely overestimate how good they're going to feel doing the easy fun stuff. And really, as you say, like normally it's invigorating, it's the challenge. And I think that's because we're so absorbed in it. Like we can't be worrying about the future or feeling bad about the past or whatever when we're playing tennis or mountain biking, because if you lose focus, then you and you're done basically. But so I think that's maybe why that's, so maybe it's they're not absorbing you like they used to. One concept that I find quite helpful is, I don't know if you read any sort of Buddhist philosophy, but you know, they talk about all these kind of ordinary pleasures as just being changing suffering, that they're not actually a source of pleasure. They're just kind of relief from whatever it was that was manifest suffering before. But if you kind of keep going with it, it will just turn into suffering again. I mean, I suppose chocolate is an obvious example. Like, if you know, when you first start, it's delicious. Second square, a little bit less delicious. Third, it's okay. And then, you know, and so on, then you start to feel sick. But,
well, and like, take an activity like writing, for instance. So people who are writers, you have to really enjoy writing to write. Like, some people write because they feel they should. They need, like, it'll be good on their resume. But to sit in front of a keyboard for thousands of hours is not really a pleasant activity. You have to really love it to do it. And I've loved it. I've written every day since 1990 until this recent period. And same thing, like, also I perform a lot of stand-up comedy. I'm a stand-up comedian. And you have to love that, because sometimes when you do it, people are angry at you while you're doing it. And so you have to be able to come back. Even if you hate it that night, you have to be able to come back the next day and say, boy, I can't wait to get back on stage and do it. But like, all of those things that normally drive me to keep on going have like disappeared. And, you know, and again, the one thing I've replaced it with, correctly or incorrectly, and this sounds stupid, is I just play like online chess and try to get better at that. But again, some days I can control myself. Some days it's like 15 hours a day when I should be doing other things. I'm admitting this to everybody in the world right now on my podcast. And again, has nothing to do with when I still try to keep the quality high when I do produce stuff. But I've just been trying to figure this out, whether it's just a time thing or what happens.
Yeah. I mean, I think time could be an element of it. Like, maybe like you're just kind of putting a lot of pressure on yourself to get back too quickly to how you were before, when maybe rather than kind of focusing on trying to go backwards, maybe just sort of embrace the momentum of going forwards. And even if you're kind of going forwards at a slower pace or in a different way, everything changes. Like, everything's kind of impermanent in that sense. So, you know, I would just kind of take one day at a time, but looking forward rather than comparing it to how you were before. Because, you know, things change whether we want them to or not. So I would kind of maybe embrace the changes and look to create, I don't know whether you respond well to having quite a regimented sort of full schedule, or whether you prefer to just kind of go with how you feel in the moment. But it, you know, it can be quite helpful to try, I don't know, maybe try and just look through your schedule and just try and plot out where your energy is at different points sort of during the day, like what you're doing at that time, who you're with, what you're thinking about, time of day, whether you're outside, inside, and just kind of try and get a feel for like what your new rhythms might be.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess I haven't really done that. I feel like my new rhythm is to do nothing. So, because again, I've been doing so, like, I was so proud of myself this pandemic. Like, I did so many great things. And, you know, every now and then I try to do all those things again. And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But like you said earlier, a lot of times the person who's burnt out, in this case me, I feel like I'm faking it so people don't worry that their projects that they're doing with me are going down the tubes, which they're not, I should assure people. But again, I've been doing just sort of bare minimum kind of stuff. Yeah. I mean, what's examples you've, like, what's the relationship between burnout and post-traumatic stress?
Yeah, I mean, it's a close one, actually. Like, there's some, you know, they do have a lot of features in common. So, like, for example, like, they both have, like, if it's, let's say you're burnt out by your job or sort of traumatized by something, then it would be like being exposed to that again leads to like feelings of like hopelessness, fear, the most extreme kind of horror, and just kind of that wish to get away from it and just put some distance between you and the thing. Disturbed sleep, feeling withdrawn, depressed, mood changes. Like, you mentioned feeling kind of more irritable. and sort of maybe a bit withdrawn, and just kind of a wish to avoid any associations that are kind of going to bring up that stressor again. And I think one of the reasons it they maybe do link up so clearly sometimes is because it feels like when you're kind of in a stressful work situation, it can feel like things are being done to you without your choice. And so it's sort of similar to the kind of trauma response, which is to kind of force apathy and numbness, because, you know, you're pushing down that kind of natural instinct to fight back and defend yourself. But while you're pushing that down, you're also pushing down all your kind of joy and your excitement and your curiosity. And then you're left with just this kind of flat state. And if you're in that state kind of over a prolonged period of time, obviously that has kind of chemical changes to your body, but also just kind of emotionally, you get into that emotional pattern where it's almost like a kind of resistance to what's happening to you, but you've got no choice. So you're just kind of passive resistance as a kind of state of mind. And you end up with this kind of numb, flat sort of feeling. So those are the kind of, I guess, the main links between post-traumatic stress disorder. And it's not really surprising. Like when you hear people talking about work, when they've been burned out, they talk about feeling like they're being stalked by their job, you know, and things being kind of forced on them. Like they do use quite traumatic, sort of violent language.
How do you see these people? What's a story where someone gets better and life's great after that?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely happens, actually. Like it's a lot of people do say that although it was kind of traumatic, although it was hugely transformative and not something that they would have kind of willingly chosen to happen to them, a lot of people do say it was a defining moment in their life in a positive way, because it forced them to get in touch with their authentic self. It forced them to kind of make these intentional changes to restore themselves to health. And in the process, kind of they ended up getting to know themselves a lot better. They formed closer bonds with people around them because they had to, you know, lean on their support network and really sort of make those links with their true authentic self and other people too. So that's a positive. Often people do change direction a little bit. Often they don't go back to the same job or same career path. They will either incorporate new interests and sort of broaden their interests, or they might change direction altogether. Because one of the things that actually people talk about when they're recovering from burnout is they realize how little of their life before that they'd actually chosen for themselves. It had all just kind of been a series of decisions that were almost made for them, or just kind of path of least resistance type things. And before they really got a chance to reflect, they found themselves in this situation that they really weren't happy with, were just kind of pushing on. So the fact that it came to a crisis where they were kind of forced out of that situation is a chance to reflect and rebuild in a way that's more in line with actually who they are, what they want to prioritize.
I mean, that makes sense, because like I feel like a couple of times in almost the distant past, I've had periods where I've slowed down a little bit, but I'm talking like in the 90s or early 00s, I actually was depressed because I had lost some money and blah, blah, blah. And I came up with like a practice of things to do that would kind of keep me healthy and uplifted while I was going through it. But this time seemed somehow worse for some reason, even though it didn't really start as depression or anything like that. And it wasn't really horrible what happened to me. It was like so ongoing and so nasty the entire time. And again, I've experienced that before, but not to this extent. And I'm being a little crybaby. Like some people have real problems. So,
no, and that's, you know, like I said, that is something that people say. I mean, don't like then beat yourself up on top of what you're, you know, what you're suffering through. It's, you know, we've all got our problems, and I don't think it's that some are necessarily worse than others. I mean, everyone's suffering in some way, whether it's openly or secretly, or, you know, physically, mentally, like everyone's got their suffering. So, you know, I don't think you should do it down necessarily. I mean, from what you said, it seems to me like you had a really nasty shock and you're still recovering from it. I mean, you've kind of pushed through to so that you are productive, like more than a lot of people would. But I think it's terrifying to, you know, I've never had anything like a million people all well, maybe after this, but all telling me
how
to
dare
hate
you
him.
Help him. what have you ever been like severely burnt out?
Yeah, I mean, in a word, yeah. So it was when I was actually doing it. At one point, I was doing a teaching and research fellowship, thinking that I wanted to go into a sort of academic career, and started doing a PhD, but actually really didn't want to be doing that. But had kind of just set off on this kind of treadmill, and it would be such a, you know, such a big disappointment to everyone to kind of get off that treadmill. That, yeah, I did get very sort of burnt out and very much sort of identified with that just feeling of being on autopilot, just very kind of numb. I've kind of felt quite isolated because I kind of wasn't able to talk to people around me and really kind of connect with them authentically. And then I was kind of almost kind of feeling resentful towards them that they didn't just psychically know what was wrong and give me permission to to quit this PhD. So that kind of created a barrier. But then, to cut a long story short, basically I ended up getting meningitis and lost my eyesight for a year.
Wow.
And and that sort of gave me a chance to pause, like an enforced pause, obviously.
So wait, you woke up one morning and you were blind?
Pretty much. I mean, so it started like I just thought I had flu. I just kind of felt kind of achy and clammy and just kind of run down. And then it kind of fairly rapidly went downhill. And yeah, as you say, then I kind of just passed out, woke up, thought I had my eyes closed, but actually couldn't see out of them. So, that was traumatic in itself. And that kind of took a long time to sort of integrate that experience.
Could you see a little bit, or was it totally black?
At first totally black. But then kind of came back just very sort of gradually, but in a weird sort of a way. Like I just kind of felt like I could see things, but it was like looking at a flat postcard. Like it's quite hard to describe, but like I would look out of the window and if I didn't know intellectually that the ground was a long way down, I would have just walked out the window. Like it just, everything just kind of looked flat. And also like I was kind of looking through a little hole, like a kind of letterbox, because my peripheral vision had gone.
It's almost like your brain that processes image, the part of your brain that processes images stopped working, and you had to kind of teach a new part. Your brain had to switch gears to a new part, and it took a while for the new part to learn from the ground up how to see.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, that was what was so kind of, you know, in hindsight, quite fascinating about it, was that my brain was fine. My eyes were fine in the sense of like my eyeballs, but the connection had just stopped working. It was like, it was, you know, they when they wrote up what had happened, they just put optic nerve atrophy, which is like the vaguest term, really. It just meant my optic nerve had stopped working.
You must have been scared to death. Did you think you were blind forever?
Yeah, for a while I did. Yeah. And it took me a long time to kind of sort of come to terms with that, really, kind of to sort of, because for ages I was just sort of saying, oh, I'm ill. I've got, you know, I'm ill and I'm getting better. It's taking a while. But then someone actually said, you're not really ill, like you're disabled. And that kind of was like, oh, I hadn't really thought of that until that point. So, and that was then frustrating because I felt like, oh, well, I've delayed so much of, I've just spent this year kind of just sitting here waiting for my eyesight to come back, when really I should have been learning Braille. I should have been, you know, I should have been getting all the equipment and stuff. But so that was a kind of, then I kind of took, sorry.
Do you think your immune system and the meningitis and the blindness was also related to the burnout? Like basically this is your body telling you, hey, we told you one way and you wouldn't listen to us. So now we're going to get a little harsher.
Exactly. I mean, yeah, to be honest. I mean, and it may just be that like I kind of, that's the story that I've come up with, but it certainly seemed like that. I mean, I was just, everything in me was telling me, no, you don't want to do a PhD. Like you don't want to be doctor, like whatever, this isn't you at all. But I just kind of kept plodding on. And I was getting so angry and angrier with myself, because like it was like my mind was saying no, my body was saying no, but then just this stupid little voice was saying, yeah, okay, yeah, I'll do that. So I was getting more and more angry with myself and picking up all the kind of coughs and colds, and my skin was bad and my hair was bad. You know, I was just very run down. And then yeah, as you say, then it just kind of all crashed, like all systems failed, and ended up catching meningitis, bacterial meningitis, and that was sort of how it came out. But the, I mean, we were talking before about can it be a positive thing? I mean, it certainly was, actually. I mean, like in on balance, like at the time it wasn't, but it really gave me an opportunity. When I think about where I'd be now, had I not gone through that, it actually like makes me quite upset, because I think I would be living some kind of quite fake life that I didn't actually want. But it kind of gave me such a second chance, really, to pause, change direction, nurture the relationships that I wanted to nurture.
Around the time that you got sick and you really broke down, so you had to not work because you were you were ill, a year later or 6 months later, whenever it was, what started to excite you? What started to bring you back to life in terms of professional activities?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was actually kind of learning again, and actually like looking, you know, finding out, getting back into that learning mindset of just being really curious about something that I didn't know much about, which was, I mean, I was still kind of doing economics, like sort of behavioral economics, but I got interested in this idea about stress and decision-making and all the kind of different factors that feed into basically how stressed people are, including kind of environmental factors. I mean, I won't sort of go bore you with all the kind of ins and outs of it, but like that was the, it was actually finding a project that was completely new where I was a beginner and really getting stuck into that. I think that was that. And I loved that. Like I get that real joy of learning came back then. And I could see how it could benefit people. I could see how it would help me. It was really kind of intriguing to me how these systems all work together and stuff. So it was finding something that I was really curious about again.
And how did you pursue studying it?
Well, I mean, at first it was, I just kind of had this rather clunky kind of Stephen Hawking voice on my laptop that would just read things out to me. So I just tried to find as many articles as I could and get those read out to me. And then I kind of fortunately had quite a few friends who were still at the university and stuff that I could, you know, say what's the latest research on this and stuff and kind of start having conversations with them. But it was really, you know, that's one of the things with a PhD, you get your little tiny area just gets smaller and smaller, and you kind of go deeper and deeper into this teeny, teeny area, and you can get quite isolated. And if it's not something that you absolutely love, then you lose touch with everything else. So it was nice actually to step out of that and just say, you know, this is an area I'm a complete beginner in, please teach me and talk to me about it. What should I be reading?
What was it frustrating at all? So you were starting this new thing a little bit later in life than you had hoped. Mm-hmm. And was there setbacks as you were learning and pursuing career and so on?
Kind of yes and no. I mean, I think if I'd kind of wanted to then sort of start again with an academic career, then yeah, I would kind of be starting again. And 7 years feels like such a long time. I mean, it's not really in the course of a lifetime, but it feels it at the time. But I sort of decided that because I didn't actually want to do that whole formal sort of academic process of, you know, doing a PhD, then you're an associate professor, then you're a professor, then you're, and all that. I just kind of thought, well, I'm not really interested in following those rules anymore. So it just kind of takes as long as it takes. And because there was no end goal, like, you know, to just get this professorship, it actually doesn't matter if it takes me the rest of my life. I don't really want this to end. I'm quite happy for it to just kind of roll on and take as long as it takes, because I'm just curious about it and enjoying it. But what I ended up doing actually was with a friend starting a training company that kind of worked with like stress and decision making. We did that for a few years and then we sold that, and so that's kind of enabled me to be able to do a bit of like early stage investing, which I'm interested in, and do try and get this burnout ideas out for people so they can really help use them to benefit themselves and things. So I'm actually kind of happy to have a sort of career that's like lots of little different projects going on at a time. Because for some people, they absolutely love the whole academic lifestyle and they love the, you know, even the rivalries, they enjoy it. But for me, it was just soul destroying. It just like really kind of got me down. So it's been brilliant actually being able to do my own thing through. But again, it's like if someone had said to me, would you like to go blind? Of course, I would have said no. but yeah. But I genuinely don't think it would have happened had I not just nothing would have pushed me hard enough to get me off that treadmill.
And how were you able to, I mean, obviously when you were sick, it was kind of a way to say, look, I can't do my usual responsibilities. Mm-hmm. I'm sick. And, you know, I like my usual things. I'm just the speed. And I feel I'm still, it's not like I'm not good at them right now, but it's like a lot of the descriptions that you say seem to apply to me. And I've been, again, trying to figure out, is there medication for this? Or like my normal practice of just being healthy in various ways in my life doesn't really seem to help because, you know, there's so many activities each day that I've been doing for years that I'm kind of like burnt out on all of them a little bit, except for maybe podcasting. Just want to make sure my podcast listeners know I love doing this podcast. But, and this is the main way I learn about the outside world now, because I just stay inside my office all day. Mm-hmm. But so I guess I think you're right, like asking questions and exploring things. But also it seems like somehow I have to figure out how to give myself a little bit of time, which is difficult.
Yeah.
You have responsibilities. So I have to kind of half and half take time.
Yeah, I can understand that. Definitely. I mean, I suppose when you can maybe, I don't know, but maybe take some time in between when you're doing your responsibilities, like figure out what you have to do. And maybe, I don't know if you could maybe batch those responsibilities together in such a way that you can just focus on those for a couple of days or something, and then maybe take a couple of days time to just do something totally different. Maybe this isn't practical, but some people find it very helpful to just go somewhere completely new and just get lost for a while. That's one way of activating your different parts of your brain. If you've kind of got a bit stuck on same few thoughts, same few routines, it's just kind of go and get lost and try and find your way home again.
What do you do with the people who are maybe frustrated because you're not your normal self? Like, let's say in your case, maybe your parents really wanted you to get that PhD and they were frustrated or upset. What do you start to tell them?
Yeah, and that was kind of one of my worries. And some of it was just completely coming from me. Like, some of it was just pure projection of what I thought they were going to react like. Generally, I think that I just had to just take it, really. Like, just kind of, if people were disappointed, just accept that they'll get over it. But I've got to live my own, you know, I've got to live this life. And ultimately, they will, if they're people that you have that authentic connection with, like, fortunately, with my parents, then they will ultimately be happy to see me happy. And this is the thing, it's almost unfair to kind of try to make out that they were forcing me to do it or anything. They had no idea that I was that miserable. They really didn't. So, you know, I think that had I been open with them to begin with, they probably would have supported it anyway. So how to deal with other people, I suppose. I mean, the people that you can be open with, I would say be as open as you can. I've found that people have almost always surprised me for the better, how they've reacted. Like, when I've said that I've been struggling or not happy to do something anymore. I mean, I just think it's essential to be clear about what you want to happen. That was something that I kind of used to struggle with quite a lot, actually just being clear and saying no to people. But I think people find it more stressful if you're, you know, doing a bit of a half-baked job for them, like you're sort of resenting doing it, but you're doing it anyway. I think it's probably better in the long run for them and for you to just be unambiguous about what you can and can't do, what is and isn't important to you.
Wow. Well, this has been really great, Natalie. I think you gave me a lot of insights into what's going on with me right now. And what are you working on right now? Like, what can I drive people towards? I really appreciate you coming on the podcast on short notice.
No, such a pleasure. So, I mean, at the moment I'm still working with individual clients, but also organizations on anti-burnout strategies, like, you know, sort of how to avoid it, how to walk back from it. But also I'm doing more work now, like we talked about, on like how to modify environments to support healthy cognitive and emotional function. So we all kind of know that like distractions and stressful environments can have a bad effect on our sort of mental function and things, but I'm trying to sort of do the opposite. So like help people create the healthiest environments for themselves.
Like, well, how can you make a home office? What are best standards for making a home office healthy?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's the biggest challenge at the moment. What I would do is maybe look at like the key elements that you want to get from your day. So I would say you want to have some inspiration, some form of connection, with other people that you have a bond with that matter to you. Also, you want some of it that you can kind of research, and you can do this digitally. You don't have to do it as in like all different rooms. You can just kind of do this with your digital world. But I think if you've got kind of inspiration, connection, a place you can actually do kind of deep focused work as well, and create your environment to support those different phases of cognitive function, then you'd be pretty close to an ideal day. And there's things you can do. I mean, nature is obviously a really good, not everyone's got that luxury, but if you've got some way of connecting with nature, even if it's just like a window or a tree, that's, you know, that there's a lot of research to show that's incredibly good for you.
Yeah, well, I have to start doing all of that stuff. But thank you so much, Natalie. And where can people find you?
So you can find me where you find me on Twitter. So Natalie Rachel R. And I also have a website, nomoreburnout.org.
Nomoreburnout.org. Natalie, thanks so much. Maybe this is not the first time I'm going to ask you on if I get worse. So
anytime. I'll be more than happy to chat with you, of course. And also, I wanted to say as well, because someone who's moved to New York, I actually read your article. And for what it's worth, I thought it was coming from a place of love. I actually didn't take offense to it at all.
It did come from a place of love. I grew up there and I've lived there until only a few weeks ago, practically. Right. And I wanted the problems to be solved. And then I don't know why everybody took it the wrong way. I mean, there was some cognitive dissonance that it triggered. And I think a lot of people who hated it didn't even read it. But, you know, it is what it is. It's like, I can't convince everybody not to feel the way they do. But thank you very much for saying that.
Sure. No, I just feel me.
Hopefully you get back to New York as soon as possible once things settle down.
That's the plan.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Natalie Rachel, and nomoreburnout.org or Twitter, Natalie Rachel R. Thanks
so much, James.